It was almost dawn when the trash can man entered Cibola, otherwise known as Vegas. Somewhere in the last 5 miles, he had lost his left sneaker, and now, as he walked down the curving exit ramp, his footfalls sounded like this. Slap thump, slap thump, slap thump. It sounded like the flap of a flat tire. He was almost done in, but a little wonder came back as he made his way down the strip, which was jammed with dead cars and quite a few dead people. He had made it. He was here in Cibola. He saw 100 honky-tonk nightclubs. There were signs that read Liberal Slots, signs that said Bluebell Wedding Chapel and 60-second wedding, but it'll last a lifetime. He saw a silver ghost Rolls-Royce halfway through a plate-glass window of an adult bookstore. He saw a naked woman hanging upside down from a lamppost. He saw 2 pages of the Las Vegas Sun go riffling by. The headline that revealed itself over and over again as the paper flapped and turned was, "Plague Grows Worse, Washington Mute." He saw a gigantic billboard which said, "Neil Diamond, the Americana Hotel, June 15th to August 30th. Someone had slashed the words, "Die Las Vegas for your sins," across the show window of a jewelry store seeming to specialize in nothing but wedding and engagement rings. As he walked on, he began to see other signs, their neon dead this midsummer for the first time in years. Flamingo, The Mint, Dunes, Sahara, Glass Slipper, Imperial. But where were the people? Where was the water? Hardly knowing, letting his feet pick their own path, Trash Can turned off the strip. His head dropped forward, his chin resting on his chest. He dozed as he walked. And when his feet tripped over the curbing, when he fell forward and gave himself a bloody nose on the pavement, when he looked up and beheld what was there, he could hardly believe it. Blood ran unnoticed from his nose to his tattered blue shirt. It was as if he was still dozing, and this was his dream. A tall white building stretched up to the desert sky, a monolith in the desert, a needle, a monument, every bit as magnificent as the Sphinx or the Great Pyramid. The windows of its eastern face gave off the fire of the rising sun like an omen. In front of this bone-white desert edifice, flanking its entranceway, were 2 huge gold pyramids. Over the canopy was a great bronze medallion, and carved on it in bas-relief was the snarling head of a lion. Above this, also in bronze, the simple but mighty legend, MGM Grand Hotel. But what captured his eyes was what stood on the grassy quadrangle between the parking lot and the entranceway. Trash Can stared, an orgasmic shivering consuming him so fiercely that for a moment he could only prop himself on his bloody hands, the unraveling end of the ace bandage trailing between them, and stare at the fountain with his faded blue eyes, eyes that were halfway to being glare blind by now. A little groaning noise began to escape him. The fountain was working. It was a flawless stone ivory, chased and inlaid with gold. Colored lights played over the spray, making the water purple, then yellow-orange, then red, then green. The constant ticking patter as the spray fell back into the pool was very loud. "Cibola," he muttered, and struggled to his feet. He began to stagger toward the fountain. His stagger became a trot. The trot became a run, the run a sprint, the sprint a mad dash. His scabbed knees rose, piston-like, almost to his neck. A word began to fly out of his mouth, a long word like a paper streamer that rose to the sky, bringing people to the windows high above. The word grew higher and shriller, longer and longer as he approached the fountain, and that word was, "Cibola!" The final ah sound drew out and out. A sound of all the pleasures that all the people who have ever lived on the earth have ever known. And it ended only when he struck the lip of the fountain chest high and yanked himself up and over and into a bath of incredible coolness and mercy. He could feel the pores of his body open like a million mouths and slurp the water in like a sponge. He screamed. He lowered his head, snorted in water, and blew it back out in a combined sneeze and cough that sent blood and water and snot against the side of the fountain in a splat. He lowered his head and drank like a cow. "Cibola! Cibola!" Trash cried rapturously. "My life for you!" He dog-paddled his way around the fountain, drank again, then climbed over the edge and fell to the grass. It had all been worth it. Everything had been worth it. Water cramps struck him, and he suddenly threw up with a loud grunt. Even throwing up felt grand. He got to his feet, and holding onto the lip of the fountain with his claw hand, he drank again. This time his belly accepted the gift gratefully. Sloshing like a filled goatskin, he staggered toward the alabaster steps which led to the doors of this fabulous place, steps that led between the golden pyramids. The doors were of the revolving type, and it took all his feeble strength to get one of them in motion. He pushed through into a plushly carpeted lobby that seemed miles long. The rug underfoot was thick and lush and cranberry-colored. There was a registration desk, a mail desk, a key desk, the cashier's windows. All empty. To his right, beyond an ornamental railing, was the casino. Trashcan Man stared at it in awe. The serried ranks of slot machines like soldiers standing at parade rest. Beyond them, the roulette and crap tables, the marble railings enclosing the baccarat tables.
"Who's there?"
Trash croaked. But no answer came back. He was afraid then, but his fear was weakened by his exhaustion. He stumbled down the steps and into the casino, passing the Cub Bar, where Lloyd Henreid sat silently in the deep shadows, watching him and holding a glass of Perrier. He came to a table upholstered in green baize, the mythic legend, "Dealer must hit 16 and stand on 17," inscribed thereon. Trash climbed up on it and fell instantly asleep. Soon nearly half a dozen men stood around the sleeping ragamuffin that was the Trash Can Man.
"What do we do with him?" Ken DeMott asked.
"Let him sleep," Lloyd answered. "Flag wants him."
"Yeah, where the Christ is Flag, anyway?" another man asked.
Lloyd turned to look at the man, who was balding and stood a full foot taller than Lloyd. Nonetheless, he drew back a step at Lloyd's gaze. The stone around Lloyd's neck was the only one that was not solid jet. In the center gleamed a small and disquieting red flaw.
"Are you that anxious to see him, Heck?" Lloyd asked.
"No," the balding man said. "Hey, Lloyd, you know, I didn't..."
"Sure."
Lloyd looked down at the man sleeping on the blackjack table. "Flag will be around," he said. "He's been waiting for this guy. This guy is something special." And on the table, oblivious of all this, Trash Can Man slept on. On August 7th, Lloyd Henreid came to the room the dehydrated and semi-delirious Trash Can Man had been installed in the day before. Trash Can Man recognized him, but could hardly remember his name. People had drifted in and out of his room like creatures in a dream. Some of their names came back to him. Lloyd Henreid, this man. A balding man named Hector Drogon. A young guy trying to grow a beard who styled himself Ace High. A constantly grinning black man who dressed in bright green and red pirate silks and called himself Ratty Irwins. "I is just a rat man, bold, black, and beautiful." That recurred. But it was all so confused. He looked at Lloyd.
"How you feeling, Trash?" Lloyd asked.
"Good," Trash Can Man said.
"Better."
"Some food and water and rest, that's all you needed," Lloyd said. "I brought you some clean clothes. Had to guess at the sizes."
"They look fine."
"You better get them on, then," Lloyd said. His voice dropped.
"He wants to see you.
Flag."
"He?"
"Yeah." Trash Can Man was transported. He got out of bed, showered, and dressed quickly. He didn't even notice how pale Lloyd looked, almost sick, or the way he kept fingering the small, flawed jetstone that hung around his neck.
"Where is he?" Trash Can asked.
"My life for him, oh yes."
"Top floor," Lloyd said. "He just got in last night, late last night, from the coast."
"No one ever sees him come or go, Trash, but they always know when he's taken off again, or when he comes back. Come on, let's go." 4 minutes later, the elevator arrived on the top floor, and Trash Can Man, his face alight and his eyes goggling, stepped out. Lloyd did not. Trash turned toward him.
"Aren't you..."
Lloyd managed a smile, but it was a sorry affair.
"No, he wants to see you alone. Good luck, Trash."
And before he could say anything else, the elevator door had slid shut, and Lloyd was gone. Trash Can Man turned around. He was in a wide, sumptuous hallway.
There were only two doors, and the one at the end was slowly opening. It was dark in there. The curtains had been drawn against the light, but Trash could see a form standing in the doorway, and eyes, red eyes. Heart thudding slowly in his chest, mouth dry, Trash Can Man started to walk toward that form. As he did, the air seemed to grow steadily cooler and cooler. Goosebumps rashed out on his sun-baked arms. Somewhere deep inside him, the corpse of Donald Merwin Elbert rolled over in its grave and seemed to cry out. Then it was still again. "The Trash Can Man," a low and charming voice said. "How good it is to have you here. How very good." The words fell like dust from his mouth. My life for you. "Yes," the shape in the doorway said soothingly. Lips parted and white teeth showed in a grin. "But I don't think it will come to that. Come in, let me look at you." His eyes overbright, his face as slack as the face of a sleepwalker, Trash Can Man stepped inside. The door closed, and they were in dimness. A terribly hot hand closed over Trash Can Man's icy one. And suddenly he felt at peace. Flag said, "There's work for you in the desert, Trash. Great work, if you want it." "Anything," Trash Can Man whispered. "Anything." Randall Flagg slipped an arm around his wasted shoulders. "I'm going to set you to burn," he said. "Come, let's have something to drink and talk about it." And in the end, that burning was very great. Chapter 39. When Lucy Swan woke up, it was 15 minutes to midnight by the lady's pulsar watch she wore. There was silent heat lightning in the west where the mountains were. The Rocky Mountains, she amended with some awe. Before this trip, she had never been west of Philadelphia, where her brother-in-law lived. Had lived. The other half of the double sleeping bag was empty. That was what had wakened her. She thought of just rolling over and going back to sleep. He would come back to bed when he was ready. And then she got up and went quietly toward where she thought he would be, on the west side of camp. She went lively, without disturbing a soul. Except for the judge, of course. 10 to midnight was his watch, and you'd never catch Judge Ferris nodding off on duty. The judge was 70, and he'd joined them in Joliet. There were 19 of them now. "Lucy," the judge said, his voice low. "Yes. Did you see..." A low chuckle. "Sure did. He's out by the highway. Same place as last night and the night before that." She drew closer to him and saw that his Bible was open on his lap. "Judge, you'll strain your eyes doing that." "Nonsense. Starlight's the best light for this stuff. Maybe the only light. How's this? Is there not an appointed time to man upon earth? Are not his days like the days of an hireling? As a servant earnestly desireth the shadow, and as an hireling looketh for the reward of his work. So am I made to possess months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise and the night be gone? And I am full of tossings to and fro unto the dawning of the day." "Far out," Lucy said, without much enthusiasm. "Real nice, Judge." "It's not nice, it's Job. There's nothing very nice in the book of Job, Lucy." He closed the Bible. "I am full of tossings to and fro unto the dawning of the day." "That's your man, Lucy. That's Larry Underwood to a T." "I know," she said, and sighed. "Now if I only knew what was wrong with him." The judge, who had his suspicions, kept silent. "It can't be the dreams," she said. "No one has them any more, unless Joe does. And Joe's different." "Yes, he is. Poor boy. And everyone's healthy, at least since Mrs. Vorman died." 2 days after the judge joined them, a couple who introduced themselves as Dick and Sally Vollman had come along with Larry and assorted company. Lucy thought it extremely unlikely that the flu had spared a man and wife, and suspected that their marriage was common law and of extremely short duration. They were in their 40s, and obviously very much in love. Then, a week ago, at the old woman's house in Hemingford Home, Sally Vollman had gotten sick. They camped for 2 days, waiting helplessly for her to get better or die. She had died. Dick Volman was still with them, but he was a different man. Silent, thoughtful, pale.
Larry is a man who found himself comparatively late in life, the judge said, clearing his throat.
At least that is how he strikes me. Men who find themselves late are never sure. They are all the things the civics books tell us the good citizen should be. Partisans, but never zealots. Respecters of the facts which attend each situation, but never benders of those facts. Uncomfortable in positions of leadership, but rarely unable to turn down a responsibility once it has been offered or thrust upon them. They make the best leaders in a democracy because they are unlikely to fall in love with power. Quite the opposite. And when things go wrong...
The judge lapsed into a thinking pause, hands clasped under his chin. He looked like a brooding black bird of prey.
When things go wrong, Lucy prompted gently. When they go wrong, when a Sally Volman dies of diabetes or internal bleeding or whatever, a man like Larry blames himself. The men the civics books idolize rarely come to good ends. Melvin Purvis, the super G-man of the 30s, shot himself with his own service pistol in 1959. When Lincoln was assassinated, he was a prematurely old man tottering on the edge of a nervous breakdown. We used to watch presidents decay before our very eyes from month to month and even week to week on national TV. Except for Nixon, of course, who thrived on power the way that a vampire bat thrives on blood. He only got old after he was forced to resign.
I think there's something more, Lucy said sadly.
He looked at her, inquiring. How did it go? I am full of tossings and turnings unto the dawning of the day.
He nodded.
Lucy said, pretty good description of a man in love, isn't it?
He looked at her, surprised that she had known all along about the thing he wouldn't say.
Lucy shrugged, smiled, a bitter quirk of the lips.
Women know, she said. Women almost always know.
Before he could reply, she had drifted away toward the road, where Larry would be, sitting and smoking and thinking about Nadine Cross.
Larry?
Here, he said briefly.
What are you doing up?
I got cold, she said.
He was sitting cross-legged on the shoulder of the road, as if in meditation.
Room for me?
Sure.
She sat down. The pavement was still warm from the heat of the day. He slipped an arm around her. According to Lucy's estimation, they were about 50 miles east of Boulder tonight. If they could get on the road by 9 tomorrow, they could be in Boulder for lunch. 3 days after Larry, Nadine, Joe, and Lucy had arrived at Stovington and found the plague control center deserted, Nadine had suggested they pick up a CB radio and start conning the 40 channels. Larry had accepted the idea wholeheartedly, the way he accepted most of her ideas, Lucy thought. She didn't understand Nadine Cross at all. Larry was stuck on her, that was obvious, but she didn't want to have much to do with him outside of each day's routine. Anyway, the CB idea had been a good one, even if the brain that had produced it was ice-locked, except when it came to Joe. It would be the easiest way to locate other groups, Nadine had said, and to agree upon a rendezvous. This had led to some puzzled discussion from their group, which at that time had numbered half a dozen with the addition of Mark Zellman, who had been a welder in upstate New York, and Laurie Constable, a 26-year-old nurse. And the puzzled discussion had led to yet another upsetting argument about the dreams. Laurie had begun by protesting that they knew exactly where they were going. They were following the resourceful Harold Lauder and his party to Nebraska. Of course they were, and for the same reason. The force of the dreams was simply too powerful to be denied. After some back and forth on this, Nadine had gotten hysterical. She had had no dreams. Repeat, no goddamn dreams. If the others wanted to practice auto-hypnosis on each other, fine. As long as there was some rational basis for pushing on to Nebraska, such as the sign at the Stovington installation, fine. But she wanted it understood that she wasn't going along on the basis of a lot of metaphysical bullshit. Mark had turned a friendly, gapped grin on Nadine's strained countenance and said, "If you ain't had no dreams, how come you woke me up last night talking in your sleep?"
Nadine had gone paper white.
"Are you calling me a liar?" she nearly screamed. "Because if you are, one of us had better leave right now."
Joe shrank close to her, whimpering.
Larry had smoothed it over, agreeing with the CB idea. And in the last week or so, they had begun to pick up broadcasts. Not from Nebraska, which had been abandoned even before they got there. The dreams had told them that, but even then the dreams had been fading, losing their urgency. But from Boulder, Colorado, 600 miles further west, signals boosted by Ralph's powerful transmitter. Lucy could still remember the joyous, almost ecstatic faces of the others as Ralph Brentner's drawling Oklahoma accent had cut nasally through the static. "This is Ralph Brentner, Boulder Free Zone. If you hear me, reply on Channel 14. Repeat, Channel 14. They could hear Ralph, but had no transmitter powerful enough to acknowledge, not then. But they had drawn closer. And since that first transmission, they had found out that the old woman, Abigail Freemantle by name, but Lucy herself would always think of her as Mother Abigail, and her party had been the first to arrive. But since then, people had been straggling in by twos and threes and in groups as large as 30. There had been 200 people in Boulder when Brentner first got in contact with them. This evening, as they chattered back and forth, their own CB now in easy reaching distance, there were over 350. Their own group would send that number well on the way to 400. "Penny for your thoughts," she said to Larry. "I was thinking about that watch and the death of capitalism," he said, pointing at her pulsar. "It used to be root, hog, or die, and the hog who rooted the hardest ended up with the red, white, and blue Cadillac and the pulsar watch. Now, true democracy, any lady in America can have a pulsar digital and a blue haze mink." He laughed. "Maybe," she said, "but I'll tell you something about this $1,000 watch, Larry. It's no damn good." "No?" He looked at her, surprised and smiling. It was just a little one, but it was genuine. She was glad to see a smile that was for her. "Why not?" "Because no one knows what time it is," Lucy said pertly. 4 or 5 days ago, I asked Mr. Jackson and Mark and you one right after another. And you all gave me different times, and you all said that your watches had stopped at least once. Remember that place where they kept the world's time? I read an article about it in a magazine one time when I was in a doctor's office. It was tremendous. They had it right down to the microsecond. They had pendulums and solar clocks and everything. Now I think about that place sometimes, and it just makes me mad. All the clocks there must be stopped. And I have a $1,000 pulsar watch that I hawked from a jewelry store, and it can't keep time down to the solar second like it's supposed to. Because of the flu. The goddamned flu." She fell silent, and they sat together a while without talking. Then Larry pointed to the sky. "See there?" She looked, but didn't see what he had pointed at until he pressed his warm hands to the sides of her face and tilted it toward the right quadrant of the sky. Then she did see, and her breath caught in her throat. A bright light, star-bright, but hard and unwinking. It fled rapidly across the sky on an east-to-west course. "My God," she cried, "it's a plane. Isn't it, Larry, a plane?" "No, an Earth satellite. It'll be going around and around up there for the next 700 years, probably." They sat and watched it until it was out of sight behind the dark bulk of the Rockies. "Larry," she said softly, "why didn't Nadine admit it about the dreams?" There was a barely perceptible stiffening in him, making her wish she hadn't brought it up. But now that she had, she was determined to pursue it, unless he cut her off entirely. "She does have them. Mark was right. And she talks in her sleep. She was so loud one night she woke me up." He was looking at her now. After a long time, he asked, "What was she saying?" Lucy thought, trying to get it just right. "She was thrashing around in her sleeping bag, and she was saying over and over, 'Don't, it's so cold, don't. I can't stand it if you do. It's so cold, so cold.' And then she started to pull her hair. She started to pull her own hair in her sleep and moan. It gave me the creeps." "People can have nightmares, Lucy. That doesn't mean they're about, well, about him." "It's better not to say much about him after dark, isn't it?" "Better, yes." "She acts as if she's coming unraveled, Larry. Do you know what I mean?" "Yes." He knew. In spite of her insistence that she didn't dream, there had been brown circles under her eyes by the time they reached Hemingford home.
That magnificent cable of heavy hair was noticeably whiter, and if you touched her, she jumped. She flinched. Lucy said, "You love her, don't you?" "Oh, Lucy," he said reproachfully. "No, I just want you to know..." She shook her head violently at his expression. "I have to say this. I see the way you look at her, the way she looks at you sometimes when you're busy with something else and it's safe. She loves you, Larry, but she's afraid." "Afraid of what? Afraid of what?" He was remembering his attempt to make love to her 3 days after the Stovington fiasco. Since then, she had grown quiet. She was still cheerful on occasion, but now she was quite obviously laboring to be cheerful. Larry had gone to sit beside her, and for a while they had talked, not about their current situation, but about the old things, the safe things. Larry had tried to kiss her. She pushed him away, turning her head, but not before he had felt the things Lucy had just told him. He had tried again, being rough and gentle at the same time, wanting her so damn badly. And for just one moment she had given to him, had shown him what it could be like if... Then she broke from him and moved away, her face pale, her arms strapped across her breasts, hands cupping elbows, head lowered. "Don't do that again, Larry. Please don't. Or I'll have to take Joe and leave." "Why? Why, Nadine? Why does it have to be so complex? Such a bummer." She hadn't answered. Simply stood in that head-down posture, the brown, bruised places already beginning beneath her eyes. "If I could tell you, I would," she said finally, and walked away without looking back. "I had a girlfriend once who acted a little like her," Lucy said. "My senior year in high school. Her name was Jolene Majors. Jolene wasn't in high school. She dropped out to marry her boyfriend. He was in the Navy. She was pregnant when they got married, but she lost the baby. Her man was gone a lot, and Jolene, she liked to party down. She liked that, and her man was a regular jealous bear. He told her if he found out she was doing anything behind his back, he'd break both of her arms and spoil her face." "Are you saying Nadine is afraid of me the way that girl was afraid of her husband?" Lucy said, "No. Wherever Nadine's husband is, he's not here." He laughed a little uneasily. "We ought to go back to bed. Tomorrow's going to be a heavy day." "Yes," she said, thinking that he hadn't understood a word she'd said. And suddenly she burst into tears. "Hey," he said, "hey." He tried to put an arm around her. She struck it off. "You're getting what you want from me. You don't have to do that." There was still enough of the old Larry in him to wonder if her voice would carry back to camp. "Lucy, I never twisted your arm," he said grimly. "Oh, you're so stupid," she cried and beat at his leg. "Why are so many men so stupid, Larry? All you can see is what's in black and white. No, you never twisted my arm. I ain't like her. You could twist her arm and she'd still spit in your eye and cross her legs. Men have names for girls like me. They write them on bathroom walls, I've heard. But all it is needing someone warm, needing to be warm, needing to love. Is that so bad?" "No, no, it isn't. But, Lucy, but you don't believe that," she said scornfully. "So you just go on chasing Miss High Pockets, and in the meantime you got Lucy to do the bump when the sun goes down." He sat quietly, nodding. It was true, every word of it. He was too tired, too priceless beat to argue against it. She seemed to see that. Her face softened, and she put a hand on his arm. "If you catch her, Larry, I'll be the first to throw you a bouquet. I never held a grudge in my life. Just try not to be too disappointed." "Lucy..." Her voice rose suddenly, rough with unexpected power, and for a moment his arms goose-fleshed. "I just happen to think love is very important. Only love will get us through this. Good connections, it's hate against us. Worse, it's emptiness." Her voice dropped. "You're right, it's late. I'm going back to bed. Coming?" "Yes," he said, and stood up. He hesitated, looking at her. "I love you as much as I can, Lucy." "I know that," she said, and gave him a tired smile. "I know that, Larry." This time, when he put his arm around her, she let it stay. They walked back to camp together, made diffident love, slept. Nadine came awake like a cat in the dark, the high iron of terror singing in her veins. "Someone wants me," she thought, listening as the mill race of her heart slowed. Her eyes, wide and full of darkness, stared up to where the overhanging branches of an elm laced the sky with shadows. "There's that. Someone wants me. But it's so cold." Her parents and her brother had been killed in a car accident when she was 6. She hadn't gone along that day, stayed behind instead to play with a friend from down the street. After the accident, she had gone to live with the aunt and uncle because they were the only two relatives, the White Mountains of eastern New Hampshire. She remembered that they had taken her for a ride on the cog railway up Mount Washington for her 8th birthday, and the altitude had caused a bloody nose, and they had been angry with her. Aunt and uncle were too old. They had been in their mid-50s when she turned 16, the year she had run fleetly through the dewy grass under the moon, the night of wine, when dreams condensed out of thin air like the night milk of fantasy. A love night. And if the boy caught her, she would have given him whatever prizes were hers to give. And what did it matter if he caught her? They had run. Wasn't that the important thing? But he hadn't caught her. A cloud had drifted over the moon. The dew began to feel clammy and unpleasant, frightening. The taste of wine in her mouth had somehow changed to the taste of electric spit, slightly sour. A kind of metamorphosis had taken place, a feeling that she should, must, wait. And where had he been then, her intended, her dark bridegroom? On what streets, what back roads, clocking along in outside suburban darkness, while inside the brittle clink of cocktail chatter broke the world into neat and rational sections? What cold winds were his? How many sticks of dynamite in his frayed packsack? Who knew what his name had been when she was 16? How ancient was he? Where had been his home? What sort of mother had held him to her breast? She was only sure that he was an orphan as she was, his time still to come. He walked mostly on roads that hadn't even been laid down yet, while she had but one foot on those same roads. The junction where they would meet was far ahead. He was an American man, she knew that, a man who would have a taste for milk and apple pie, a man who would appreciate the homely beauty of red check and gingham. His home was America, and his ways were the secret ways, the highways in hiding, the underground railways where directions are written in runes. He was the other man, the other face, the hard case, the dark man, the walkin' dude. And his run-down boot heels clocked along the perfumed ways of the summer night. Who knoweth when the bridegroom comes? She had waited for him, the unbroken vessel. At 16 she had almost fallen, and again in college. Both of them had gone away angry and perplexed, the way Larry was now, sensing the crossroads inside her, the sense of some preordained mystic junction point. Boulder was the place where the roads diverged. The time was close. He had called, bid her come. After college, she had buried herself in her work, had shared a rented house with two other girls. What two girls? Well, they came and went. Only Nadine stayed, and she was pleasant to the young men her changing roommates brought home, but she never had a young man herself. She supposed they talked about her, called her spinster-in-waiting, maybe even conjectured that she might be a carefully circumspect lesbian. It wasn't true. She was simply waiting. It had seemed to her sometimes that a change was coming. She would be putting toys away in the silent classroom at the end of the day, and suddenly she would pause, her eyes lambent and watchful, a jack-in-the-box held forgotten in one hand. And she would think, a change is coming. A great wind is going to blow. Sometimes, when such a thought came to her, she would find herself looking back over her shoulder like something pursued. Then it would break, and she would laugh uneasily. Her hair had begun to gray in her 16th year, the year she had been chased and not caught. Just a few strands at first, startlingly visible in all the black, and not gray, no, that was the wrong word. White. It had been white. Years later, she had attended a party in the basement lounge of a frat house. The lights had been low, and after a while, the people had drifted away by twos. Many of the girls, Nadine among them, had signed out for overnight from their dorms. She had fully intended to go through with it, but something that was still buried beneath the months and years had held her back. And the next morning, in the cold light of 7 a.m., She had looked at herself in one of a long line of dormitory bathroom mirrors and saw that the white had advanced again, seemingly overnight, although that, of course, was impossible. And so the years had passed, and there had been feelings, yes, feelings. And sometimes in the dead grave of night she had awakened both hot and cold, bathed in sweat, deliciously alive and aware in the trench of her bed, thinking of sex in a kind of gutter ecstasy. And the mornings after, she would go to the mirror and she would fancy that she saw more white there. Now the change had come, and in her dreams she had begun to know her bridegroom, to understand him a little, even though she had never seen his face. He was the one she had been waiting for. She wanted to go to him, but she didn't want to. She was meant for him, but he terrified her. Then Joe had come, and after him, Larry. Things had become terribly complicated then. She began to feel like a prize ring in a tug-of-war rope. She knew that her purity, her virginity, was somehow important to the dark man, that if she let Larry have her, or if she let any man have her, the dark enchantment would end, and she was attracted to Larry. She had set out quite deliberately to let him have her. Again, she had intended to go through with it. Let him have her, let it end, let it all end. She was tired. She had waited too long through too many dry years. She had brushed his initial advances away with a kind of contempt, the way a mare might switch at a fly with her tail. She could remember thinking, if that's all there is to him, who could blame me for rejecting his suit? But there was more to him than that, as she had seen. He was like one of those optical illusions, maybe even to himself, where the water looks shallow, only an inch or two deep, but when you put your hand in, you've suddenly got your arm wet to the shoulder. The way he had gotten to know Joe, that was one thing. The way Joe had taken to him was another. Her own jealous reaction to the growing relationship between Joe and Larry was a third. At the motorcycle dealership in Wells, Larry had bet the fingers of both hands on the boy, and he had won. Had her judgment been that much wrong about Larry's character? The nervous, self-serving exterior was a veneer, and it was being worn away by hard use. Just the fact that he had held them all together on this long trip spoke for his determination. The conclusion seemed clear. Beneath her decision to let Larry make love to her, a part of her was still committed to the other man. And making love to Larry would be like killing that part of herself forever. She wasn't sure she could do that. And she wasn't the only one who had dreamed of the dark man now. That had disturbed her at first, then frightened her. Fright was all it was when she had only Joe and Larry to compare notes with. When they met Lucy Swan and she said she'd had the same sort of dream, fright became a kind of frenzied terror. It was no longer possible to tell herself their dreams only sounded like hers. What if everyone left was having them? What if the dark man's time had come around at last, not just for her, but for everyone left on the planet? This idea, more than any other, raised the conflicting emotions of utter terror and strong attraction within her. She had held to the idea of Stovington with a nearly panicky grip. It stood by nature of its function as a symbol of sanity and rationality against the rising tide of dark magic she felt around her. But Stovington had been deserted, a mockery of the safe haven she had built it up to be in her mind. The symbol of sanity and rationality was a death house. As they had moved west, picking up survivors, her hope that it could somehow end for her without confrontation had gradually died. It died as Larry grew in her estimation. He was sleeping with Lucy Swan now, but what did that matter? She was spoken for. The others had been having two opposing dreams, the dark man and the old woman. The old woman seemed to stand for some sort of elemental force, just as the dark man did. The old woman was the nucleus the others were gradually cohering around. Nadine had never dreamed of her, only of the dark man. And when the dreams of the others had suddenly faded away as inexplicably as they had come, her own dreams had seemed to grow in power and in clarity. She knew many things which they did not. The dark man's name was Randall Flagg. Those in the West who opposed him had either been crucified or driven mad somehow and set free to wander in the boiling sink of Death Valley. There were small groups of technical people in San Francisco and Los Angeles, but they were only temporary. Very soon they would be moving to Las Vegas, where the main concentration of his people was growing. For him, there was no hurry. Summer was on the downside now.
Soon the Rocky Mountain passes would be filling with snow. There would be a long winter in which to consolidate, and next April, or May... Boulder was her last hope. The old woman was her last hope. The sanity and rationality she had hoped to find at Stovington had begun to form in Boulder. They were good, she thought, the good guys. And if only it could be that simple for her, caught in her crazy web of conflicting desires. Played over and over again like a dominant chord was her own firm belief that murder in this decimated world was the gravest sin. And her heart told her firmly and without question that death was Randall Flagg's business. But oh, how she wanted his cold kiss, more than she had wanted the kisses of the high school boy or the college boy, even more, she feared, than Larry Underwood's kiss and embrace. We'll be in Boulder tomorrow, she thought. Maybe I'll know then if the trip is over or... A shooting star scratched its fire across the sky, and like a child, she wished on it.